You are now listening to the eWatchmen podcast with your host, Robert King.
Hello, everyone. Welcome. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Watchman's Post podcast. This program was recorded for October in the year 2014, the 100th anniversary of the kingdom having begun ruling, supposedly, according to the Watchtower. God's Kingdom Rules, that's the name of their latest publication. But I think a growing number of Jehovah's Witnesses are beginning to realize that it just ain't so. Not to say that Jehovah's Witnesses don't believe the truth and have the true faith, but there are a few adjustments in order coming down the pike. And that's what my website is all about. And as you probably know, the format of the podcast is entertaining questions from readers of the Watchman's Post. You may have noticed that I have a new feature on the website, and that is, I used to have a toll-free number. You had to pick up the phone and call. You could leave a voicemail, and a few people did that, but I haven't had many calls the last many months, and so I dropped the phone thing, but now you can record right off of your computer, and if you download the app, you can record a message from your iPhone or your iPad or whatever, and if you specify, I can use your voice on a podcast here, or if not, I'll simply read and answer your question. So, take advantage of that. It saves wear and tear on your keyboard if you leave a voicemail. Anyway, I've got a number of questions here, so let's get to them. This person quoted something I said about the coming war and so forth. And they say, their comment is, obviously in the book of Revelation, this is a result of the seventh trumpet blowing and the third woe. I just wondered whether or how you identify the other six trumpets and the other two woes. And then they add, regarding the society, they have said the seventh trumpet blowing in 1914, although the latest thinking is Satan was thrown out of heaven a few years later in 1918. But no, the seals have not been unsealed yet. The trumpets have not blown yet, and the bowls of God's anger have not been poured out yet. And we can be sure that it will not transpire over a century of time. Once the kingdom comes, things develop over a relatively short period of time. Included in that period is the 3.5 years, but it's not going to extend on for years and years, decades, and now over a century. That's just ridiculous. All right, another question here. I have a question concerning those with the hope of being resurrected on the earth. I often hear Jehovah's Witnesses say, including yourself in your video on the 144,000, that the vast majority of all those who've ever lived and died will be resurrected back onto the earth. That's true. But according to various sources on the internet, it is estimated that over 100 billion people have lived and died from the inception of mankind up until now. If it is, as you suppose, that the vast majority of those who would be resurrected, then that is a lot of people. Can the earth really sustain a number so magnitudinous? You don't hear that word very often, do you? Is that? And considering that death will be no more, the Earth's population would surely be out of control in no time at all. Will our ability to procreate be curbed? I realize that any response from you on this matter is pure conjecture. Nevertheless, I would be interested in hearing your thoughts. Okay, well, yeah, I like to conjecture and speculate with the best of them. I hope you can't hear my cat meowing in the background. I just fed him. I don't know what his deal is. First off, that 100 billion people having lived on the Earth is way, way, way out of line. I mean, that is total conjecture, no doubt by people who believe in evolution, that mankind has been on the Earth for millions or billions of years and whatever. That's just ridiculous. I've got a webpage in front of me here. It's called onesimpleidea.com. Everything's spaced with a hyphen, like E-Watchman. Anyway, it looks like it's fairly reasonable here. The world population, according to them, at the time Jesus was born, was about 250 million people. In 1492, when Columbus discovered the West Indies, there were 500 million, half a billion. By 1804, population reached 1 billion. By 1922, 2 billion. 1959, 3 billion, so forth. Now there's 7 billion, and they project by 2039, 8 to 13 billion. Okay, interestingly, and I may have mentioned this in a podcast years ago, and you have to forgive me because I don't re-listen to my podcast, so sometimes new listeners, they'll listen to a number of the programs maybe that I did years ago, and they'll say, well, you said in, you know, podcast number 13, blah, 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 and I can't remember that because that program may have been 3 or 4 years ago. Anyway, so you have to forgive me if I repeat myself because I can't remember what I said 3 or 4 years ago, as I'm sure you can't either. Anyway, I had a Bible study with a mathematician back in the 1980s, and he was apparently pretty brilliant. He came up with the zip code system for the U.S. Postal Service. That was his claim to fame, anyway. But I wanted to engage his mind, you know, in the truth, and I think he was coming from the evolutionary standpoint, and I gave him numbers such as this, and I asked him if he had enough stats like this, if he could extrapolate the point at which mankind began. And he thought that was a really cool thing, and he worked on it. And the next week I went back for his Bible study. He had 3 or 4 pages scribbled out for me, and it was very interesting because he came up with a date about 4,000 years ago. About 4,000 years ago for the beginning of mankind, which would correlate fairly closely with the time of Noah's flood. And we have to remember that basically the population was reset to zero or to 8 people at the flood. And from there, the present population emerged. So anyway, forget about the millions and millions of years and 100 billion people, whatever. And this website, One Simple Idea, goes on to consider that the square miles of the Earth and the United States, and it mentions that in the U.S., there is only 8.9 acres per person in the U.S. Only! There's only 8.9 acres per person. Oh, my, that's just terrible overcrowding, right? Well, let me ask you, how many acres do you have right now? Some of you may have acreage. You may live on a farm or something like that. But I think most of you probably live in a house with a little yard and, you know, less than an acre probably. And if you do live on an acre of land, how long does it take you to mow the grass, for example? I mean, that's a pretty big job, isn't it? I think I mentioned this. I don't really like to talk about my personal affairs, but my wife and I bought a farm a few years ago with an old farmhouse, which coincidentally, the house was built in 1874, the year C.T. Russell and his friends got together in Allegheny. How cool is that? Anyway, we have about 5 acres of grass, you know, in the barn and an old smokehouse and all that. It takes me about a day on a riding mower to do the whole lawn and, you know, trim it and all of that. And we have a little garden that I've had for the last couple of years. And it's not a very big garden. I mean, it's about the size of maybe the square footage of an average size two-car garage, something like that. You know, we plant a few rows of sweet corn and lots of peppers, kale, cabbage, cauliflower, green beans, some sunflowers, lots of tomatoes, onions. And I used, you know, organic compost on this thing. And the garden, you know, last year was better than this year. I think we had a really hard winter and it stunted some things. And it really didn't get warm until, you know, mid-May. But this tiny little garden produces more food than my wife and I can handle. I mean, she's learned how to can. She makes, you know, salsa and pasta sauce. And we had a few apple trees as well. And they last year was just unbelievable. Thousands and thousands of apples that, you know, we couldn't use them all. We made applesauce and apple juice, and I gave them to the horses, you know, across the road when we go for a walk. And this year didn't produce any apples, again, the winter. But the point is, this little plot of land produces more food than my wife and I can ever handle. I mean, if we had a large family, I mean, easily you could produce enough. Well, our neighbors across the road, they have, I think, 3 kids and a bunch of goats. And, I mean, they got a really working farm there. And they planted a huge garden, I would say probably a quarter of an acre. And just a bumper crop of pumpkins. And they can everything, you know, their corn and green beans. Or they freeze it. You know, he told me he put it in the freezer for his family. And, you know, easily 8.9 acres per person for 300 million people. And here's the thing, you know, people do not live solitary lives, do they? So a family of two, that would be 16 acres for them. Four, double that, right? 32 acres. Let me tell you, a family of four could not keep up with 32 acres if you cultivated the whole thing. You couldn't do it. So it's interesting, you know, in the Bible, when the spies went into the promised land and they brought back some of the fruitage of the land of Canaan, and there was a cluster of grapes that was so enormous that they had to loop it over a pole, and 2 men carried this cluster of grapes on their shoulders. I mean, it must have weighed, I don't know, a couple hundred pounds, you know. But that was without really even Jehovah's blessing. Just imagine the earth in the new world when, you know, we figure out what we're doing as gardeners and learn how to feed the soil. And, you know, a small little plot could easily feed, you know, a whole family. And who's to say that, you know, there's not going to be cities in the new system? I'm sure there will be. People like to live close to each other and, you know, not all crammed into these mega cities with, you know, 10 million people or something. That's ridiculous. But I envision cities of a few thousand or a few tens of thousands, and every city being unique, and everyone has their little rooftop gardens and surrounding areas where they grow everything, you know. And that's something to kind of use your imagination. But anyway, obviously, I mean, the earth can support many, many more billions than it is presently. I mean, under this beastly system, they disallow the Earth to be used. You know, how many millions of square miles is cordoned off as, you know, national parks, and you can't touch this, it's government property, and they disallow people from developing in the third world, and it's horrible. I mean, it's Satan's system. He wants people crammed into these cities so he can drive us all crazy. But a new system, each person will have their own land if they choose. I mean, you won't work for another person. Everyone will work together as a communal thing. And I'm sure the Earth could support many, many billions. But it is a finite planet. So at some point, what would we do? No one dies and the population, okay, maybe it could support 100 billion. I'm sure it could. How about 200 billion? I mean, at some point, you would there'd be people falling off the Earth, right? Now, obviously, no one knows the answer to that. I'm not really a sci-fi fan, but, you know, we can't disallow Jehovah doing something wonderful. Like, for example, the universe is a pretty big place, right? I mean, there could be other planetary systems, other star systems like ours, and with the same, you know, gravitation and all the things that, you know, make life possible the way we know it here. So, I mean, and that could go on forever, right? I mean, there's no end to the Jehovah's creative ability. And why should we imagine there's a wall at the end of the universe there somewhere, empty space? I mean, it just keeps going on. But what if Jehovah took persons from, you know, this earth, Adam and Eve's, and transported them to another planet to start off? The advantage of that would be that they would know what happened on this planet with Satan the devil, rather than Jehovah just creating two new creatures that didn't have any history or knowledge of history. I mean, when God created Eve, he put Adam to sleep, right? And took his rib. So why couldn't Jehovah take a man and a woman and put them into some sort of sleep, and they wake up on another planet and, well, don't know what to do, right? I don't know. It's just, I wouldn't rule that out. I know it sounds far out, but hey, the whole creation is pretty far out and awesome, but we accept its existence, don't we, because it's undeniable. The other less exciting possibility is Jehovah just takes away our ability to procreate. I mean, after all, he could have created every person individually, but he allowed humans to carry out his creation called procreation. So at the end of that creative period, yeah, God may just say, okay, thanks. Well, let's see, right? I mean, we've got the whole future in front of us. This, you know, the end of the system is like a big black curtain, but our faith allows us to see behind that, doesn't it? Into the indefinite future. I remember a governing body person a few years ago, he said that, he explained what it meant to me to be made in God's image, and he said that it means to live as long as Jehovah does. And that's really a profound thought, I think. The animals were not intended to live forever, but we were. And it's Jehovah's intention that we do live forever. So it's good that we think in terms of living forever. And, you know, this little problem of overpopulation, I'm sure it's not going to be a problem, whatever. Jehovah can handle it, and I'm sure it'll be the perfect way. Right. Magnitudinous. Yeah, that's a good word. Okay, my question is, as Jehovah's Witnesses believe that the light of understanding gets brighter But according to prophecy, God's people are in a state of blindness up until the moment when Christ Jesus arrives and commences the cleansing and refining work. Where do people like you and I and many others fit into that equation? It says God's people. I would hope that we would also be classed as his people too. But are we to be part of this state of blindness at some point? Well, you know, the blindness is not the sin, necessarily. I mean, really, when it comes down to it, Jehovah has caused the blindness, or at least he allows Satan to cause it. But in the instance of the apostles, for example, Jehovah caused their blindness when it came to not appreciating that Jesus had to die. I think it's in the 9th chapter of Luke, and I've referred to this, you know, many times, but that's where Jesus pulled them aside and began explaining to them that the Son of Man was going to go up to Jerusalem and be betrayed and be put to death. And it says that the apostles couldn't grasp it. And it says, in fact, they were forbidden from seeing through it. And the reason Jehovah didn't allow them to understand it, as I've also mentioned many times, that they had to be tested. Their faith had to be tested when Jesus was suddenly taken from them. Would they continue to put faith in this Son of God, or would their faith be shattered? And then, of course, when Jesus was resurrected, then he appeared to them and he rebuked them for being senseless and slow to believe and all the things the prophets spoke. And they, you know, they had to accept that rebuke, and they benefited from it, and their eyes were opened. Jesus opened up the prophecies to them, as it mentioned. Well, same scenario is going to be played out. But it's how we'll respond to God's rebuke and his humbling and his teaching of us. And only the meek will bear up under it. Those that are proud or lack faith will not. And so again, I don't know that answers your question, but where does that leave us? Well, Jesus said that, you know, those who do the will of God will receive the blessing. Not everyone saying to me, Lord, Lord, will enter into the kingdom, right? Many will say to me in that day, didn't we prophesy in your name and expel demons in your name and all of that? And Jesus says, get away from me. I never knew you. All right, so, but it's the one who does the will of his Father. So what is Jehovah's will? If we're Jehovah's Witnesses, we surely must know. That's the whole point. And is it Jehovah's will that we be part of this system, well, part of this world in any way? Of course not. So how can we identify ourselves as God's people? Well, one way would be to stay free from being part of this system. If you're not associated with the organization, where are you going to go? You're going to go back to the, you know, what, you're going to join another religion, or you're going to, you know, celebrate birthdays and Christmas and all of that stuff? Where would that leave you? And this person says, you know, where does that leave people like you and I and many others? Well, I have to say, I am in somewhat of a unique position. I can't go back to the organization. I could. You know, as a matter of fact, I had a couple of elders come by here the other day, because about a month ago, an elderly couple came by one Saturday morning, and they were sharing in the distribution of the tract that was, you know, advertising the JW.org. And I thanked them, and I told them I was disfellowshipped, and they left. And maybe the brother was an elder anyway. I'm sure he told the elders. And every September is when all the elders, you know, go through their territory and try to encourage those who are disfellowshipped to come back. So, like I say, a couple weeks after that, a couple elders stopped by one morning, and I asked them in, and they asked me, well, can we ask what happened? And I said, well, you know, it's a long story. I didn't want to get into it at that time. I I've been to the local Kingdom Hall here. In fact, the brother that came by here, I recognized him. He was the Watchtower study conductor, and he approached me after the meeting, and I told him then I was disfellowshipped, but I didn't tell him where I lived. I guess the other couple did. But anyway, I know, you know, I could go back to the organization and be reinstated for sure, but I would have to take the website offline. I would have to take Jehovah Himself Has Become King out of circulation. I'd have to stop the podcast, take my videos down. You know, any criticism of the Watchtower would be considered, you know, an act of apostasy. So I'm not ready to do that. And it wouldn't be for your benefit if I did, would it? But most of you aren't in that position. So I encourage people to go back if you're ostracized and not part of it. I mean, then you could have some sort of ministry. As I consider this my ministry, but I don't think most of you have that sort of calling or that sort of ministry that, you know, I've carved out on the internet. So I don't think most of you are in the same position as I. So I think I've said enough. Now, this person had emailed me some questions last month, and they didn't make the last podcast, and then they rephrase some of the things and left them as a comment on a post on the Watchman's Post. So I'll take this opportunity now to consider their questions. Is the 3 1/2 year period consist of everything from the first seal to the last trumpet to Armageddon, or is it just the span of the Great Tribulation alone? Okay, well, the 3 1/2 year period, it begins, well, according to Daniel, it begins when the constant feature is removed. And if you go into Revelation, it's basically the same thing. When Satan is thrown down, he goes off and persecutes the woman, and a place is given for her in exile for 1,260 days. Same thing in the 11th chapter. After the beast comes out of the abyss, he goes off to war against God's people and conquers them for 42 months. So from the time the kingdom comes to power, and of course Satan is thrown down, and immediately goes against those who are sons of the kingdom and suppresses them, conquers them. At the end of that period, Daniel goes on to say, as soon as the dashing to pieces of the power of the Holy One comes to an end, all these things will come to their finish. Well, the Watchtower says that happened back during World War I. So, okay, how did all of these things come to a finish? Well, they can't answer that, can they? Because obviously they didn't. It's nonsense. But verse 11 goes on, says, from the time that the constant feature has been removed and the disgusting thing that causes desolation has been put in place, there will be 1,290 days. And then it says, happy is the one who keeps in expectation and arrives at the 1,335 days. So there's different features of this chronology that will become apparent when the time comes. I can't say how these things will play out, but I'm certain that at the end of that 1,335-day period, there will be no chosen ones on the earth. They will be with Christ in heaven. So in that respect, they are happy. And they will be in heaven. All of them will be in heaven with Christ, all of the 144,000, when Armageddon comes, because they're all with him. According to the 14th chapter of Zechariah, all the holy ones are with him when he comes to destroy the wicked. So the dashing of their power is in terms of their being on the earth. And of course, as soon as they're put to death, they become immortal spirits, and that changes everything, doesn't it? Their next question, it says, does the Bible text at Daniel 12:1 have a literal meaning that all those whose names are written in God's book will come out of the Great Tribulation? Well, having your name written in God's book just means that He acknowledges you and He allows you to gain salvation. In other words, there won't be anyone who survives the Great Tribulation by accident. You know, I mean, right now you have this prepper movement of, you know, people stockpiling, you know, food and ammo and guns and gold or whatever, you know, and they expect to survive, you know, whatever's going to happen, but they're not going to. Only those who have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. In other words, our faith is in Christ and we're obedient to Him as King and we're willing to die for Him if necessary. And Jehovah grants them salvation. It won't be by accident. It will be because of their course and their faith. Okay, another question here from the same questioner. What might the Great Tribulation consist of? Is the Great Tribulation just war, famine, and pestilence, plus annihilation of people by the Eighth King? Or are war, famine, and pestilence only a precursor to the Great Tribulation? Well, I think things will unfold relatively rapidly because there's no way that this global political financial system can endure war, famine, and pestilence. It will, you know, cause the financial system to crash, and without the money system, the political system comes down. So, yeah, things, you know, the unsealing of the seals will happen relatively quickly over a short period of time, weeks or months. And the Great Tribulation is when this political system comes down. That's described in the Revelation, the mountains come crashing down, stars fall from heaven, the moon turns to blood, and this, you know, it will be as if the world is ending right then and there, and people will beg for the governments to protect them, fall over us and protect us. And from the ashes will arise the Eighth King, and then he will go on a genocidal rampage. And that's always been the intent of the empire anyway, to reduce the world's population. They think the world is overpopulated with 7 billion and want to get it down to about 1 billion for their convenience. And apparently Jehovah is going to allow them to carry that out. The difference is the war, famine, and pestilence, the opening of those first four seals is followed by death and Hades. So those who are killed and this coming world war and famine, pestilence, will have an opportunity for a resurrection. But once the Eighth King comes to power, and that's when the marking begins, the 666, because it will be a direct competitor to the kingdom then, and anyone who compromises their faith to stay alive or whatever, says no one will be able to buy or sell, and if you don't get the mark, you're put to death. So those who compromise will not have their names written in the book of life, and their death will be permanent, the second death. No one has their name written in the book of life who accepts the mark of the beast. So that's the Great Tribulation, when this Eighth King terrorizes the world. They have a fourth question here. For people like us, who are already out of the organization, what else can we do in order to follow what Jesus said, to run away when we see the disgusting thing that causes desolation? And where are we going to run? Well, no one has seen the disgusting thing that causes desolation. That's the whole point, right? That's what begins the 3.5 times of judgment. So we can't justify leaving the organization because we're following Jesus' command to flee. You haven't seen the disgusting thing yet. And it hasn't trampled on the holy place or brought an end to the constant feature. So what can we do now? Like I said, the will of Jehovah. What is Jehovah's will? Well, part of it is to preach and teach, Make disciples? Isn't that Jehovah's will? That's what Jesus is sponsoring through the Watchtower in spite of all of its... You know, even Jesus, I mean, when he was on the earth, he was a faithful, loyal, law-abiding Jew. Even though he knew that the system was corrupt and that Jehovah was going to destroy it, he still lived within the Jewish law. Take, for example, when he cleansed a leper on more than one occasion. What did he tell them to do? Go present yourself to the priests and offer up the gift that Moses prescribed. Even though he knew that the entire Mosaic system, it was done. Jesus was fulfilling the law and setting up a new nation and a new covenant. But like I say, he went to the synagogue. He preached in their synagogues. That's similar to the kingdom halls today. So Jesus stayed within that structure. And I don't offer any alternative to that today, even though it may seem hypocritical that I'm outside of it. I think I've explained my position and why, and Jehovah makes exceptions, right? Well, each of us will have to stand or fall before our judge and king. Okay, in a different vein here, she quotes the prophecy, or not the prophecy, but Paul's writings in the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians about love. Love never fails, but if there are gifts of prophecy, they will be done away with. If there are tongues, they will cease. If there is knowledge, it will be done away with. For we have partial knowledge, and we prophesy partially. But when that which is complete arrives, that which is partial will be done away with. So the question is, in what sense of which was he writing? What is prophecy and what did he mean by it? And what is knowledge? Well, the early Christians prophesied. They had the gifts of prophecy and they had the gifts of special knowledge. They had the gifts of tongues. Those were all miraculous gifts that were imparted to the congregation. And those are the things that will be done away with. Their final question here, what does it mean when that which is complete comes? What does it mean? And is it talking about the Bible as a completed work? I think in some sense it is, because keep in mind that the original first century Christians did not even have personal copies of the Bible. Certainly they didn't have what we call the New Testament, the Greek scriptures. Because those books, or letters, many of them, were not written until years and years into the Christian era. And they were few. And they were passed around from one congregation to the other. So people didn't have their own personal copies. That's why you had to go to Christian meetings. And maybe someone had a scroll that Paul had written a few years ago. Maybe the letter that he had written to the Philippians, maybe it was passed around to the Galatians after a year or two, and they got it, and they copied their own copies, and so on. So they needed those special gifts to edify them and strengthen them. But eventually, as the Christian era came to a close, all these letters were compiled, copies were made, more and more copies, and codified, and what we now know is the Bible was compiled. And as the evidence shows, those gifts of special knowledge and special prophecy and tongues and interpretation of tongues, that was all phased out. But Paul is really, if you read on in that 13th chapter, ultimately he was talking about the return of Jesus and all those things being done away with. He says, then we will see him as he is. So even now, our understanding is partial. I think I demonstrate that, you know, when people ask me questions about like the 3.5 times and all that, I don't know all the answers. I'm looking, you know, through the haze as we all are. You know, it's easy to show that the Watchtower is wrong. I mean, I've pounded them into oblivion on the 1914 thing, but you know, as far as really establishing the absolute truth of what the prophecies mean, I'm not there, and no one is. And until Christ comes, no one will be. And that's the point. Our knowledge is incomplete right now. But what did Paul say? Hope, faith, and love, these three, right? So that's what we want to develop, faith in God's word, faith and hope in the future, the reconciliation with God, the salvation from Christ, and the love of God, the love of the truth, and the love of each other. All right, well, I'm going over my suggested half an hour program, but I don't want to let some of these questions go another week or so. So bear with me. My first question is, this is a follow-up to a question in the last podcast about Hebrews, the first chapter. And he said Paul was quoting from Psalm 102, but then Paul applied that to Jesus rather than to Jehovah being the creator. And the person asked, do you understand my confusion? Maybe it's just a silly question. I understand that Jesus is the agent of creation and all things were created through him, but reconciling a passage such as the one in question with my scripturally founded understanding that Jehovah is the creator is killing me. Well, I don't understand why. I mean, go to the Hebrews 1:1, and Paul says it right there, that the Son created all things. He said, long ago, God spoke to our forefathers by means of the prophets on many occasions and in many ways. Now, at the end of these days, he has spoken to us by means of a Son whom he appointed heir of all things and through whom he made the systems of things. So he says it right there. Jesus made the entire system of things. But is Jesus a creator? No. Why isn't Jesus a creator? Capital C. Because Jesus could not have done it on his own. That's the whole point. Jehovah empowered his Son, allowed him to do it, instructed him. And that's why we read in Genesis, let us make man in our image. No, it just shows how generous Jehovah is, even though he's the creator. And plus, the fact is that the identity of the Son and his role, basically, it was a sacred secret. So that's why you never hear about the Son in the Hebrew text really being, you know, this creator. It's hinted at, like I say, in Genesis, let us, and so on. Proverbs, the 8th chapter, I was the one next to Jehovah's wisdom. So, but when Jesus came, then the sacred secret was revealed that, yes, Jehovah's creator, but all along his Son was next to him, and he was really the agent that Jehovah used. So I don't see why a person should be confused about that. Okay, now here's a stumper question for the E-Watchman. According to your understanding, who is the false prophet spoken of at Revelation 19:20? Well, the Watchtower says it's the Anglo-American beast, doesn't it? But I don't believe that to be the case, and I can't say for certain who it is, but I think in the 18th chapter or 17th chapter of Revelation, when the scarlet-colored beast ascends from the abyss with the harlot on its back, there's a period there before the harlot is destroyed. And that scarlet-colored beast, the Bible says that it is the eighth king. And so there are these two entities that will exist during that tribulation period. The harlot, she'll still have a voice, and the beast. And during that period, Jehovah's Witnesses are laid low and come under the influence and authority of this harlot. And that's that's why it becomes necessary at that point for God's people to heed the command to get out of her, my people. And that will involve exiting the organization, which at that time will obviously compromise to stay in existence and become part of this Babylonish system and part of the, you know, the eighth king. And I think that will be the false prophet. And Jesus said, well, you know, many false prophets will arise and false Christs during that time. That time hasn't come yet. Jesus said the deception would be so thorough that, if possible, even the chosen ones would be deceived. Well, how is it possible for the chosen ones to be deceived now by Christendom? It's not. But they can be deceived by the Watchtower, because they view that as Jehovah's mouthpiece, his earthly organization. So if it becomes apostate, which it will, Paul said that, you know, Christ will not come unless the apostasy comes first. We've seen hints of it with, you know, this NGO thing and all that, but we really haven't seen the full-blown thing. And we haven't, the man of lawlessness has not been revealed yet. And he hasn't sat down in the temple. We see the mystery of this lawlessness at work, but we haven't seen him sit down and claim to be the God or a God. And that's in the future. How it will play out again, I have partial knowledge. I don't know. I don't think it's important to know. All we know is that things are going to change in the future, and at what we think, what Jehovah's Witnesses think, how it's going to unfold is not the way it's going to happen. And that's going to be the test. Okay, well, I guess that is going to do it. Keep in mind the voicemail thing, if you feel up to that. Keep questions coming. I'm going to try to make the podcast more frequent. I'd like to do a weekly program, but it sort of depends on how many questions I get. But I'll try to do one next week. Until then, thank you for listening. And may Jehovah continue to bless your search for the truth.